I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. It's a presidential election year, and Florida's election rules are coming under fire. A program meant to eliminate non-citizens from the voting rolls identified a World War II veteran as a possible violator. 52,000 possibly dead voters also identified, and a federal judge ruled against part of the state's election law. We'll talk about that with our political commentators, Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Plus, we'll discuss the FCAT controversy and state political races, and Dick and Lou are in for their monthly political roundup. And that's ahead on Intersection. And I'm joined in studio by 90.7's political commentators, Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Dick Batchelor, of course, former Democratic State House representative and founder of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Welcome, Dick.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Great to have you in. Also, Lou Fry, former Republican congressman and attorney at Lowndes, Drostick, Doster, Cannon, Reed. Lou, good to have you in.
And we're looking forward to the 20th Fry Institute Symposium, which is going to be on the Constitution. Is it irrelevant?
Well, let's get into elections. The Justice Department has ordered the state of Florida to stop purging voters from its rolls who are believed to be non-citizens. Governor Rick Scott ordered the program, sparking criticism among Democrats who say it's targeting Democrats and minorities. We heard about this 91-year-old World War II veteran among those ordered from the rolls. The Justice Department warned the program could be violating two laws. So where does this controversy go next, especially for the Governor Scott and the Secretary of State, Lou Fry?
Well, first place, I think we all would like laws that let people who are here and have the right to vote, vote. And secondly, I don't want 50,000 dead people voting.
You've obviously never run in Chicago.
Yeah, I know. That's right. And so I think this is a bipartisan issue in the sense that what people really want. The question comes, though, when you look at it and it goes into action, who is getting which people are not registering as much as they think they should? And I think in this case it is a potential Democratic voters. What are you going to do about it? Well, I guess you can end up in court.
What do you think, though, in terms of a legacy image, seeing Florida just having one voter issue after another?
Oh, it's just not Florida. It's all over the country in terms of these things. Anytime you have a legislation like this that impacts somebody's right to vote or to not vote, you know, you're going to have it. We still have images of the guys up in Philadelphia with the guns, you know, keeping people from voting. And that wasn't prosecutable. So maybe they ought to go back and look at that and look what's going on and try and balance it out.
Well, Dick Batchelor, how do you see this shaking out?
It's a conundrum, and it won't go away till after the election. And I'll tell you why. First of all, there are several pieces of it. One, the legislature passing what some of us believe the restrictions on them able to vote, and the courts have thrown those out, at least two provisions, one dealing with the 48 hours requirement that you have to turn in newly registered voters. Secondly, you've got this whole issue about, are there illegal immigrants actually voting? Are there dead people registered to vote? If they are, they probably won't vote. I'm just guessing there. But what's going to happen, this reminds me a little bit of, you know, Gore versus Bush.
I was going to ask it. Does this sound like 2000?
If and then in the State Department, which is Justice Department, which obviously is Barack Obama administration, is now weighed in now and pushed back a little bit on any action being taken by supervisors' elections. I would suggest that this race is close, and it will be this year. Will come back to haunt them, and they're going to have to. I don't know whether they're going to purge the rolls or whatever, but they'll count every single vote, and they're going to have to validate the votes. After the election, that's going to be that close.
Do you think it's going to be a hanging chad, Lou Fry?
Hanging chads this time. It'll be
yes,
more than
and dangling more than chads.
Yeah.
And just
I think Florida is going to be the key state on who controls the Senate. I think the Nelson race is going to be. And I think you got to carry Florida. Whichever party carries Florida is probably going to win the presidential race. So there's an awful lot at stake on
this. I guarantee there is a cadre of lawyers on both sides are looking at this issue. And if it's another, margin like it was on Gore versus Bush, this issue could come back and Florida could be a pivotal state again. And unfortunately, building a reputation, which is not very good to begin with.
Well, meanwhile, a federal judge has imposed a temporary injunction on part of the state's election law overhaul last year. The law requires voter registration groups to turn in those registration forms within 48 hours, signing up new voters. The judge agreed with critics who said the requirement could disenfranchise voter registrations. And, of course, Lou Fry, as you pointed out, this is a battleground state, 29 electoral votes, the most of any of these battleground states. So What do you weigh in for this controversy? How's that going to impact these election year politics?
It's the most important factor in everything we're talking about. If you could take out the fact we're in a presidential race, these issues you're talking about would be worked out, solved. People would work on them together and figure out a way to do it. But both people's backs are against the wall, if you will, and this is not going to be solved pleasantly or easily.
Who are the winners and losers?
Well, let me tell you how. Figure out how it comes out. You know, tell me who's going to carry the, who's going to get the most votes and who's going to lose the less votes, and I'll tell you who's going to win or lose.
What do you think on that Electoral College front?
Well, obviously, with the 29 votes in the Electoral College, that it's the third highest state now, they're key votes. You can't do it. You can't lose Florida. You can't lose Ohio. You can't lose Virginia. I mean, there's states that you just can't get there. And we, as usual, are at the top of the list, which means we're in the rifle sights of everybody, which means it's going to be a bloody mess.
Dick Batchelor, how do you clean up that mess?
Well, you try to clean it up by working through what the federal court has said. Now, the court only ruled on one or two provisions I alluded to earlier. One's the 48 hours, you know, the new legislation, which basically said you could collect new voter registration files, but they had to be within 48 hours, and now it used to be 10 days, and which is ludicrous to begin. We've had, like, school teachers go out and do voter registration, turn them in over 48 hours, and they're facing, you know, statutory violation, maybe a criminal act or at least a civil penalty. You know, so it's really a mess, I think, the way they've done it, and it's not going to be resolved here. Again, I defer to my first comments and lose agreement, I think, and that is it will be solved if this election is close, and it will be. It will be solved after the election, and I hope Florida is not put in the same position it was in 2000.
You know,
we could go months before we know who the president is.
And hopefully we won't be in that position.
Hopefully. Yeah, we all want that.
Well, talking about the Electoral College, I did see briefly that Florida Democrats had put out their nominees as those superdelegates. Dick Batchelor, I wonder, any names rise to the list here locally that we should pay attention to?
Frankly, not locally. I've been out of the country for 2 weeks, so I don't know. But I can tell you in the Tampa area, obviously it made sense that Bob Buckhorn is the incumbent mayor over there in the host city for the Republican National Convention. So he's a delegate. And Bob Graham, of course, the former United States Senator Governor, is a superdelegate too. So I think statewide they're picking some very strong people because, as Lou said, Florida is going to be a very important state.
You know, so much attention was put on those superdelegates in the last election. Lou Frey, you think they're going to rise to such prominence again, or have we seen the rise and fall of the superdelegates?
I think sort of the rise and fall. You've got to have something going on, like the Reagan-Ford primary or the Clinton-Obama primary, whatever. And if it's not there, the superdelegates get the nicest seats and probably get the first drinks at all the receptions. But outside of that, they really don't do much.
But I also read if you give $250,000, you can get guaranteed very nice seats at the Republican convention.
Can you?
Sure.
You want to sign the check for me?
$250,000 is what it takes. buy lottery tickets.
Probably better spent.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. They're worth at least more than $250,000. Dick Batchelor and Lou Frey are political commentators. Democrat Dick Batchelor, former State House Representative. Republican Lou Frey, former U.S. Congressman. I'm Mark Simpson. What do you think about these election controversies in Florida? You can let us know on Facebook and Twitter. You can always send an email also over to intersection@WMFE.org. You know, the FCAT, that standardized test that all Floridians know about at this point, is under fire again. Writing scores released last month were shockingly low. It prompted an emergency meeting among state educators who agreed to reduce the passing grade so that school funding would not be drastically affected. Of course, you got more students passing when you shift that goalpost. And criticism is growing among those who say, look, this is just too much testing detracting from education. The state imposed tougher FCAT grading restrictions this year in preparation for new national standards that are supposed to take effect in 2015. So what do you say, Lou Frey? Were you shocked at all about these scores? And do you think there's going to be more changes coming through on the FCAT?
Well, when you look and what we've been involved in with Dick is civics, trying to get civics taught in our state. We are 46 in civic illiteracy in the state of Florida. 42% of the people can't name the three branches of government. And, of course, we haven't had any civics courses. Most of your teachers have never had a civics course in college. So why should you be surprised if we don't know what the rules of the country are? We don't know that the Constitution is our leading legal document. Why should we be surprised that the other scores aren't good? I am not so sure the answer is to say, gee, the scores are bad and let's lower them. I'm not so sure that's the way. For instance, we're going to have a test in eighth grade, seventh grade, for all the students in the state when they get there that they have to pass to go to eighth grade. It's not an FCAT test, but it's certainly a test that puts a lot of pressure on teachers to teach and young people to learn about our government. And so I think there are ways you can do it. I am not willing to give up on some kind of testing. There has to be some sort of accountability. You just can't say, we didn't do a good job and go on from there.
I think I just recently read about 48 days of standardized mm-hmm. testing in the school year. Does that sound like too much to you, Dick Patchell?
It does sound like too much. First of all, you've got to have some way to register what people are learning. We did not have that. I always tell young people when I speak to them that I'm glad that I graduated before FCAT was required, because I'd still be in Evans High School and shot making birdhouses or something.
We're sending you back.
Well, I know, and it's obvious that I need to go back, too. But you've got to have some level of testing, whether it's under state FCAT, it's under No Child Left Behind, the federal regulations. You have to have some kind of testing. You've got to measure what people are learning. Look, we're going to get our lunch eaten again by countries like China and other countries that are extraordinarily competitive, particularly in the sciences and the maths. And so we have to have testing. But the question is, are we over-testing, number one, and number two, how are the tests to be validated? We're so obsessed with it now. As you alluded to, I think it was a local article said the 45 to 48 testing days a year. So,
don't you think that's too many?
And the question, it begs the question, are you teaching to the test? Are you really learning anything? And that's where, and it's complicated, I understand that, but somebody's got to be able to tease that apart.
What do you think in terms of what the State Board of Education did, moving that goalpost, improving the scores, so to speak? Is that the right thing to do, should they just chalk it up and say, hey, you know what, this is a bad year?
What I call an approach avoidance conflict. On one hand, you're attracted to the grades, but then you're repelled by the grades, so you move the goalpost, as you alluded to. The fact is, you also have another one that makes it even more complicated, that you've got your end of term test now, like in algebra. Only about half the people pass the algebra exam for the ninth grade. There's got to be a way to kind of tease it apart and have it more validated, more scientific. You've got to have testing, but you can't teach to the test because people aren't learning at that point in time. And I'm sure there's a solution there someplace, but not at the opposite end of the spectrum. You've got to have some kind of testing.
Sure. I don't want to talk too much about a paranoia, but talk to me, Lou Fry, about Jeb Bush, his foundation for Florida's future as an education consultant in this state pulls a lot of sway. We also see Kathleen Shanahan, the state chairwoman of the Board of Education.
Who is Bush's finance chairman.
Former Bush chief of staff as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
We see a lot of Jeb Bush influence in the shadows here. Should we read into that? In terms of education policy in the state?
I personally am not at all upset that someone who cared about education in the state, and I think did a pretty good job and a pretty fair job, is interested in education. Does it say that there may be some politics in it? Of course. You know, of course there's some politics. Does it mean that at some point in the future, depending on what this happens, that Jeb could be a candidate for the president out of Florida with a base in education? Yeah. Of course it means that. But I think I give him a pass. I think it's needed, and I think he's adding to a somewhat reasonable debate on education.
But has that kicked off the culture of testing that you and Dick were just talking about, saying, hey, now we've gone too many days testing and there needs to be changes?
Well, common sense is not illegal. You know, it's scarce, but it's not illegal. And if we're doing 50 days of tests, it seems to me that we should be able to come up with something and maybe do 30 or 35 and reduce the number and, you know, maybe even do it on a lottery system. The kids don't take all the tests at one time. Maybe they take two or three one year and two or three the next year. And there's got to be a better way to do it.
What do you think, Dick Batchelor? Is the hand of Jeb Bush handprint too big in Florida education circles?
Well, someone once said that just because you're paranoid doesn't mean someone's not out to get you. Number one, I agree with Lou that Jeb Bush was, I think, on the heels of Bob Graham, who was the education governor. I think Jeb Bush was too. And it really is not the testing at all. What bothers me a bit about the proposal is, are we privatizing public education? And, you know, by the corporate income tax, where you can actually basically waive that in lieu of funding a private scholarship. Charter schools, proliferation of charter schools, not having the same requirements, though. In a charter school, you don't have to pass the FCAT. You don't have the same restrictions as you do in public school. So are we overly privatizing public education? At some point in time, are at a point of diminishing returns where public education becomes secondary as far as the importance of funding as it is now in the legislature, in my opinion, and the private education takes over. That's my concern.
I think, and that's the underlying theme, really, and that's the way Bush has pushed stuff. Remember the charter schools and all these things? I think he's very comfortable in that arena, and so that's probably the biggest issue.
You know, we do see also around the state some school boards, including here locally, rejecting the FCAT outright. I mean, that is a pretty loud statement for local school districts or school boards to come out and reject those tests. I mean, where does that leave the dialogue?
Let me tell you what the dilemma is right now. It'd be one thing to have an honest conversation about privatization of the public school system, charter schools and private charter schools and private schools and tax credits and all that, if the legislature put public education funding on par. It is not. You know, it's about $2,000 per student less than it was 4 years ago. So the legislature, on the one hand, is woefully underfunded public education, but at the same time adding additional restrictions on them, encumbering them additional restrictions, and at the same time making it easier to privatize what we would call charter schools. On one hand, if it was on par, it would be fair, but it's not fair because public education is losing out in this debate. If you would go back and fund public education, as every legislator says they want to do, but they fail to do, on par, then you would have a competition because charter schools are fine. And it should be fine if you can give me a scholarship and I could choose a school to go to, particularly when I'm minority students. But you can do that. It could only be fair, though, if the funding is on par and is not on par and not on parity.
And when are the parents going to get involved? The parents are really going to get involved when their student has gone through, finished 12 grades, applies to get to school, and you get a rejection because you're from Florida with the problems in Florida and that and your education, or you don't do well in the tests, you know, the SATs or the law school, whatever it is, if you don't do it, then the parents are going to wake up and say, gee, you know, we've got to do something about education. And that's,
but you know, but this goes even beyond that, Lou, and I think, to follow up on that thesis real fast here, we've got about 35,000 to 40,000 unfunded FTs in the community college system. So what we're telling kids, we're unfunding
FTs.
Public education, full-time equivalent. Funded positions that are not funded, classroom seats that are not funded. So what happens, you're reducing the funding for education K-12. Then when a kid does graduate, passes the requirements and all, so eligible to go to community college, you're saying you can't go because we haven't funded those seats. So you're basically saying stay at McDonald's. Then the university system, what we're doing there is we've increased tuition 15% a year, 45% in 3 years. So we had this convergence here, which was a big conflict because kids can't get into college, can't afford to be in college, so we're underfunding education. So to me, the legislature is a total failure when it comes to education.
Yeah, and you don't cut $2 billion 1 year and then only $1 billion
and bring it back,
but you're still $1 billion short.
Well, certainly a conversation to continue on. We're listening to the Intersection Monthly Politics segment. We've got our commentators, Republican Lou Fry and Democrat Dick Batchelor, and this is Intersection. Well, let's talk about congressional races that are kind of interesting around our area. A new poll showing Congressman John Mica, Republican incumbent, up 30 points against Congresswoman Sandy Adams. The poll shows that Republican voters prefer Mica over Adams, 55% to 25% in the District 7 primary. So, Lou Fry, does that just mean the race is over? Aside from the fact that John Mica's been there for so long and is such a well-known name.
Those are the polls. Her polls show a little bit better, but there's no question that John Mica is in a pretty solid position. And as long as he keeps doing what he's doing and doesn't make a mistake, he's going to be very difficult to beat. The other part is money in these campaigns becomes more and more important. And the Washington has basically cut off the money to Sandy and congressional help and so forth. So she's out on an island. And that's not a good place to be.
You know, that district she was in, out in the Merritt Island area, speaking of islands, but what...
That's a bad pun.
I didn't say this was a classy show here. What, though, do you think pushed Sandy Adams to make this move? Redistricting? To try to challenge someone like Mica?
I just think she was put in a bad position by reapportionment, redistricting. Both the districts, by the way, that either she or John could run in are about the same in Republican representation. They're both Republican districts. The problem with the one district is a lot of people jumped in that one, and Sandy saw, I think, four or five people in there already, and she didn't want to get in. Well, on the other hand, you know, John's home is in that one, and as a senior person, you know, you normally defer to it. And so I spent some personal time. I like them both. They're both friends, saying, you know, we can't lose either of you. And why not at least, Sandy, with the odds and the money and so forth, why not try and run in that other district? But it wasn't, since Sandy wanted to do something different. And
now, Dick Batchelor, not to keep going with puns here, but you're hoping that John Micah paves over Sandy Adams maybe in this race? Or what do you think?
And she's already in a pothole. If I can another bad pun. I think what Lou was right. I want to decipher what Lou said. Lou said both are friends. Whoever wins is his best friend. But I think
it's a difficult position.
Oh, it is. We thought for early on that Sandy might go in a different district, not go get John Micah. What she understands, one, is that money is really, really key. And John Micah is a very pleasant guy to deal with. But when it comes to politics, he's been playing it for a long time. I served in the legislature with him, and he will play for keeps, and he will cut the money off if he can, one. Number two, what she's underestimated is when you've been in the legislature and you've been in Congress for all the years he has, you've established these relationships that she's only had a short period of time to try to, 1 year to establish in D.C. And he's done, the constituent service and all, that really adds up after a while. So, I was surprised she stayed in there. It was like rehearsing for political suicide, but I don't see any way that she could ever beat John Micah.
Well, yeah. And John's been a good congressman.
It's going to be your best friend when he wins.
He's my uncle.
Well, Lou Fry, you alluded to the U.S. Senate race as one of the most interesting in the state and maybe even on a national level, too. But I said
important. I didn't say interesting.
Oh, well, I'm going to throw you something that I thought was interesting.
All right.
Okay, former Congressman Dave Weldon jumping in the primary. Yeah. Dave Weldon used to be a really well-known name, the doctor, right?
Yes, 14 years in the Congress.
Out in Brevard, Space Coast.
Yep, Space Coast. Good guy. You don't get many chances in the political game in lifetime where you can get a U.S. Senate seat with very little work. You're looking at filing now. You've got 2 months for the primary, and once you're the nominee, anything can happen. I mean, so you're really getting a chance with no work at all to hit that lottery. If I was a few years younger, I'd get Dick and he'd run on one side, I could run on the other.
Well, you could run at 50. Go ahead.
Yeah. But it's an amazing opportunity. And Weldon, I talked with him. He said, why not? It's a chance. I think I'd be a good senator. Probably the tide's against me. Lemieux can't even break 10%.
Okay, so Lemieux, we know, has been kind of an underdog in this for a while. But what about Weldon, Connie Mack?
Well, I don't think that Weldon has the chance to raise the funds to run statewide. And Connie Mack, remember, has got all these commitments from people. So Weldon's opportunity to go to Mel Martinez or a lot of the big fundraisers is sewn up, and remember, you've only got a couple months on this campaign. I'll bet you. You take a poll on Weldon and the name, and you take out Brevard County, and I bet you his name recognition is under 10%.
Oh, way lower than that. I agree with you.
Well, what do you think, Dick Batchelor? Dave Weldon getting in the race, is Bill Nelson sitting there going, "Hey, great, these two guys are going to slog it out, and I can sit back, or what's going on?
I think Dave Weldon getting into the race has as much impact as two postcards from Bithlo. I don't think it has any impact at all.
Hey, our listeners in Bithlo are going to write in on
or Orla Vista, my hometown. You can do either one. No import. And he's not going to raise any money, number one. Number two, I should say. But Connie Mack, the thing that amazes me about the Connie Mack Lemieux, you got Lemieux, the former United States Senator, of course, appointed by former Governor
his best friend,
and he just can't get any traction. And even Connie Mack, if it were not for his father's name, Connie Mack, the former United States Senator, who's very well respected, he hasn't gotten much merit traction either. Now, having said all of that, if Connie Mack's the nominee, there's plenty of PAC groups, and there are all these super PACs. There'll be money. Connie Mack will have money to run against Bill Nelson, but Bill Nelson's got $10 million in the bank, and he doesn't have a primary, so he's up there. But it's still about a $30 million race.
Well, you mentioned Charlie Crist there, so I'm going to go to Charlie Crist because I think my favorite poll in recent days here is the one that shows Florida Governor Charlie Crist beating current Governor Rick Scott in a 2014 gubernatorial matchup. This poll run by Florida Opinion Research assumes Crist would get in that race, of course, and survive a Democratic primary. We always love to speculate on Charlie Crist, and I saw him on the John Morgan commercial the other day invite me to call just to say hi, but he never calls me back, Dick.
Well, your neck didn't hurt. Did your neck hurt? Can you give him a call again? Those numbers are so early on, and people like to speculate with those things, but the fact is, the incumbent governor's popularity is still under 40%, so the former governor, Charlie Crist, has name recognition. But will he, could he get nominated as a Democrat and win the primary? You know, I really don't know. And in fact, personally, begs the question, why do you want to? If you're making probably a couple of $1 million a year, why do you want to be
governor? Charlie's going to run for office at some point. I'm convinced it may be the congressional seat. It may be one of these. You know, you got three people sitting as in the cabinet who all want to be governors if the governor falls himself. And so I wouldn't be, you know, that would not shock me to find out that Charlie's announced for something.
Charlie's for the people.
Yep.
He is for the people.
He just wants to be for 51% of the people. That's all.
Well, what is Rick Scott think about this? Does he even bat an eye seeing this poll this early? And
it depends on how much money he's willing to spend. He says he's not going to spend his own money next time. He doesn't have to, but that begs the question. He spent $78 million last time, but if he likes being governor well enough, I'm sure he's prepared to spend money. So, but, you know, we'll see. We could talk another time about potential candidates on the Democratic side. But if Charlie Crist gets in, though, with the name recognition, though, he's you got to put him up in front of the line.
All right. Let me ask you, Dick Batchelor here. Scott Randolph, local state representative, says he's not going to run for reelection. Instead, wants to be chairman of the state Democratic Party. That the current chairman, Rod Smith, stepping down at the end of the year. Randolph is currently the Orange County Democratic Executive Committee chair. So good move for Scott Randolph to walk away from that seat.
Well, if he wants to be chairman of the party, I mean, I don't know. That's, you know, I was asked once if I wanted to be chairman of the party. I said it'd be like being over a lot of people, but none of them would listen to me. So I don't know what that really means.
It can be a thankless task.
Well, it pays $100,000 a year, but it's a thankless task unless you just really like the grassroots politics of it because you have to satisfy a lot of constituent groups. But, you know, I guess what he's really saying, and I'm not trying to put words in his mouth, is that he was going to have a hard time getting reelected in a district.
And so, also, being in the legislature in the minority is not near as much fun as being a legislator in the majority. I mean, that's a lot of people have taken steps to get out of the minority. A lot of my friends up in Washington, we never thought we were 50 years in the minority.
You know, being chairman of the party, I've said, and either party this applies to, so it's not partisan. It's just that it's like you know, watching an octopus roller skate. You know, you see some movement, but you don't know in particular direction it's moving at any particular time. So
you and cephalopods, I'm not going to get into that.
Good luck to him.
Dick Batchelor, what do you think, though, and Lou Fry, weigh in on this too briefly. State Democratic Party, Rod Smith wasn't there too long. Karen Arteman, much longer tenure. What does that say about internal politics, movers and shakers in that party?
I don't know. To be honest with you,
Dick Batchelor, you don't know.
I don't know. Again, I don't mean to be overly critical of either party, but parties don't play that much of a role in politics anymore. They, if you look at the local Democratic committee, you know you're entitled to how many precincts we have? 350 precincts. There are probably 50 members of the local Democratic committee. So the Democratic Party or Republican Party can help you to some degree, but they can also hurt you. But that's not where the money goes. These elections are now going to be dictated by PACs and super PACs, and the party becomes less and less significant in these political races, in my opinion.
Yeah, you're right. They do, however, have some impact when it's a race and you can go precinct to precinct and do some organization. That does make a difference, and it makes a difference symbolically.
Well, that's Lou Fry, former Republican congressman, attorney at Lounge, Drostic, Doster, Cannon, and Reed, Democrat Dick Batchelor, former State House representative, and founder, president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. You can visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. Sign up for our weekly podcast there. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening. We'll be right back.